Tales of the Left Hand, Book 3, written and read by John Maher. The story so far. While Kerla and Teska struggle to adapt to their new situations, let's take a look at what some other characters in our story are up to. Chapter 15. Oryk Fane's face was a mask of subservient sympathy as he watched Ambrose storm about, barking orders. Inwardly, he savored his younger cousin's impotent rage. It compensated for a part of what he'd been forced to endure since the Osprey had come to Maipor. Ambrose's arrival had not been a complete surprise to him. When the Cutlass had limped into the harbor, he'd gotten that itch, that Fane instinct for survival and intrigue, warning him to be on alert. There was something about the ship's silhouette, the way her hull was disfigured. That was the word for it, he had decided. He'd looked at the ship through his spyglass, then later from a better vantage point after she docked. Some of the hull's timbers were twisted, the gaps stuffed with whatever the crew had available. The strange mass bulging out of the starboard side aft reminded him of a cankerous growth infecting a tree. And he was positive he'd seen leaves growing from the tops of the masts. It was unnatural. He'd lived in Maipor almost his entire life. He'd seen many damaged ships stagger into port, crippled by fire, collision, or storm. But he'd never seen anything like what had happened to the Cutlass. The ship's name had also nibbled at his memory. Hadn't he heard something about a ship with that name a few months ago? Someone with a price on their head? The name by itself wouldn't have been enough. There was more than one ship in the Frieze with a simple name like the Cutlass, but she also flew the Duke's flag. He was under strict orders to make note of Kohaian ships that came and went in Maipor, especially those that were part of the ducal fleet. All of these factors had contributed to that itch, that prickling at the base of his skull. He knew he'd be hearing from his Kohaian cousins to learn more about this ship and her business. He just hadn't expected that to happen so quickly, or that Ambrose would be handling the matter himself. The last time he'd seen Ambrose, Draxon Fane's heir apparent had been a surly youth. Draxon had come to Maipor for a visit, bringing his children with him to show them the family holdings here. Oryk's father had been alive then, and the elder cousins spent most of their time closeted away talking business, leaving Oryk to entertain Draxon's children. Ambrose had been the model of a spoiled prince. He had spent Oryk's money with great abandon, gambling, drinking, and whoring his way through the city. Twice, Oryk's men had narrowly prevented him from getting carved up by an irate Maiporian who tucked his hands into his sash while the Fane scion berated the man for a perceived slight. Oryk felt that the only thing that had changed about Ambrose was that he'd grown larger, both in appetite and muscle. He'd only been in town one night, but Oryk's funds had already felt the grasping pinch as Ambrose enjoyed copious amounts of the best food, wine, and women Maipor had to offer. The only thing Oryk was grateful for was that Ambrose hadn't insisted Oryk join his revels. Oryk didn't object to any of the pleasures Ambrose was chasing, but he preferred to savor such things, lingering over far smaller quantities of such delights over the course of an evening. Ambrose's gluttony repulsed him. A pity Draxon didn't send his daughter instead, Oryk reflected. Alessandra had been far easier to deal with than her older brother. She was as haughty as Ambrose, there was no denying that, but she was more polite about it, confining her distaste for Oryk's home and city to a bored expression. She had spent much of her time on her own and hadn't caused Oryk any grief. Except for that one evening, when we couldn't find her anywhere in the manor, Oryk remembered. Then I started getting reports about a young woman matching her description, traveling through the city unaccompanied, and even fighting a duel. He gave an inward shudder. Lost a night's sleep over that one. Try and be thanked those rumors proved to be false, and that we found her asleep in a corner of the library the next morning, well before Draxon heard anything about it. A yawn struggled to escape him, but he kept it down. The last thing he wanted was to attract Ambrose's ire. The man was looking for a scapegoat, someone to blame for this fiasco, and Oryk knew his cousin well enough now to know anything might set the furious young man off. But Oryk was not a young man, and he was feeling the effects of his early rise this morning. An hour before dawn, one of his servants had hastily knocked on his door to tell him the Osprey's sails were afire. After a fumbling scramble to the window, Oryk took the spyglass from his servant and put one bleary eye to the lens. As soon as he saw the scuttling, gleaming bodies of the armorbacks clinging to the nets and moving about on deck, his blood ran cold, snapping him fully awake. For a full minute, he watched the battle unfold. Then, surrendering to the inevitable, he told his servant to wake Ambrose. The rest of the pre-dawn morning had been a blur of chaos. Ambrose had raced down to the docks, demanding Oryk shuttle him out to the Osprey at once. Oryk had refused, even when Ambrose drew his sword and threatened to drag Oryk back to Kohane or kill him where he stood. It wasn't until Oryk was able to explain to Ambrose that there wasn't a man in the city who'd take his ship into the bay before sunrise that Ambrose, with much shouting and cursing, had finally settled into a fuming, stormy silence. As soon as the sun had fully cleared the horizon, Ambrose would no longer be restrained. Oryk would have been just as happy to let Ambrose head out to the Osprey alone, but his cousin insisted on Oryk's presence, probably in revenge for Oryk's refusal to go out on the water before dawn. As they neared the ship, a rope ladder was tossed down for them, and Ambrose scrambled up to the deck of the Osprey the moment he could grasp the ladder.
"Where in the scrumping hells is Kern?"
came his furious demand as Oryk took the ladder himself and followed Ambrose up. The sight aboard the ship was ghastly. At least 5 armorbacks and perhaps 3 times as many men lay dead. The sailors had begun to sort these out, shoving the carcasses of the armorbacks into a rough pile and laying out their own with reverence.
"Captain's gone, sir,"
one of the sailors said, reluctantly stepping forward and knuckling his forehead to Ambrose.
"Gone?" Ambrose growled. "I don't see him lying here."
"They took him, sir," the sailor replied, looking pale. "Armorback carried him over the side."
That seemed to take some of the wind out of Ambrose's sails.
"Sun's balls," he swore. "All right, the first mate then. What's his name? Spavey?" "Down below, sir, with the surgeon. He lost most of a leg to one of their claws. He's not like to serve—"
"Fine, fine," Ambrose fumed, cutting him off. He paused, looking at the sailor more closely.
"You're the bosun, aren't you?"
"Yes, sir. Peller, sir."
"Congratulations, Peller. You're captain now. Do a good job and you might keep it. Now, tell me what's happened."
"Well, sir," Peller stammered, "it was the start of morning watch, when suddenly the mainsail just burst into flame. A moment later, there's armorbacks everywhere, drawn up by the light and noise."
Ambrose scowled.
"Kern put up his precious equipment, didn't he?"
"Yes, sir, but it didn't seem to work. I don't know why."
"Sabotage,"
came another voice. Both Thanes turned to see Garrick Cabot coming up from below. He was resting a long-handled wooden mallet over his shoulder. The head was spattered with gore, and Cabot hadn't bothered to clean himself off either since the battle. His wide eyes gleamed out of a face stained with dried blood and ichor. Oryk noted that all the sailors moved a step or two away from him, their expressions a mixture of awe and fear.
"Sabotage?"
Ambrose asked, his lip curled in disgust at Garrick's appearance. Then suddenly his eyes went wide.
"The prisoners!"
"Gone,"
Cabot said, looking at Ambrose with the same blank expression he always seemed to have. "All 3.
"Gone?" Ambrose demanded. "Where in the hells could they go out here?"
"Stole the gig while the armorbacks attacked," the smuggler went on. "The things didn't give them no mind either. Walked right past them like they weren't there. Smelled odd."
"I noticed that too," Peller offered. "A few of the lads who came up for that last watch stank to heaven. I would have chided them for it, but we were on silent orders."
Ambrose thought about that.
"The musk. That damn musk Kern insisted we buy. I've smelt it. It's horrid. But it's supposed to go on the nets. That's what Kern said you're supposed to do with it."
"We put it on the nets as ordered," Peller replied, "but it didn't smell near so bad as I was led to believe."
"Like we said," Cabot put in. "Sabotage."
"Sabotage," Ambrose repeated. "So, someone made the musk useless, but saved some for the prisoners, then lured the armorbacks onto the ship?"
Peller glanced toward Cabot for agreement, but Cabot continued to stare blankly at Ambrose. Eventually, the Osprey's new captain nodded.
"We have a traitor on board," Ambrose growled.
"Not anymore," Cabot informed him. "It was your cabin boy. Will saw him get into the gig with the others.
What? My cabin?
Ambrose bared his teeth, his fists clenching and relaxing. A low snarl began as he turned this way and that, rising quickly to a roar of fury.
You saw them escaping, Cabot, and you didn't stop them? What good are you?
Cabot shrugged, taking no notice of Ambrose's insult.
I put a dagger in the left hand's belly, and he fell over the side. Them that was in the gig pulled him out of the water as they cast off. Might be dead by now.
You're not sure?
We was busy, the smuggler replied, adjusting the position of the mallet on his shoulder. Will thinks he saw the gig heading for shore west of the city. Might be able to see it now.
He walked up to the Fanes and plucked Oryk's spyglass from his belt, then strode to the rail, set his mallet down, and began to look back at the coastline. As Ambrose and Peller began to bring activity on the Osprey back to a semblance of order, Oryk excused himself to the quarterdeck, as much to get away from the sight and smell of the carnage as out of his cousin's direct line of sight. In time, the deck of the Osprey was mostly clean, though there were still places where blood had pooled, staining the wood. The armor-back bodies had been dumped over the side without ceremony. Normally, after being sewn into bags of sailcloth and weighted down, the human dead would have received a blessing and been sent into the water as well. But the crew, by unspoken agreement, would not be doing that today. They all knew too well what would befall any man, dead or alive, who entered these waters.
Oryk, damn you! Get down here!
Ambrose bellowed from the main deck. Oryk sighed and descended the steps to join his cousin and Garrick Cabot. The smuggler still had not cleaned himself up. The smell coming off of him prompted Oryk to breathe through his mouth. He'd tucked Oryk's spyglass into his belt. Oryk had no intention of asking for it back at this point.
Cabot spotted the gig, Ambrose said with satisfaction, about a mile past the walls. Looks like they tried to hide it under some branches. He's going to take your launch over there.
Oh, is he?
Damn right he is. None of your back talk now. Peller will send a few lads from the Osprey along. They'll bring the gig back here, and Cabot will see if he can pick up Sicarius's trail.
He's headed for the Abbey, said Cabot. Will's sure of it.
Ambrose made only the briefest pause to meet Oryk's eyes and shrug at Cabot's mention of his dead brother.
But like you said, Sicarius took a knife in the belly. He might be dead by now. Triad knows he wasn't looking too good after I'd finished with him, eh? So, best we find that out.
And we wait here until the launch and the gig come back? Oryk asked.
Not bloody likely, snapped Ambrose. Peller will take us into port on the Osprey. There's no point sitting out here two nights in a row, now that the prisoners have escaped, and the mess should make the inspectors less interested in doing a full search anyway.
He turned to Oryk.
That'll be your job. Make the inspectors happy. Make the paperwork go quick. By then, Cabot will have found out where they're going, and he'll meet us back at your house. Then we're off.
Oryk cringed inwardly at the thought of Cabot knowing where he lived, not to mention crossing his threshold.
Off? To the Abbey, numbskull. Even if Sicarius is dead by now, the elves up there, and Grievous, and the map.
Cabot nodded and turned toward the ladder that led down to the launch.
We'll be off then.
At least wash yourself for the father's sake,
Oryk called after him, unable to hold the words back. Cabot stopped and turned back, his blank expression unchanged.
What I mean is, you'll not be allowed to enter the city looking like that, Oryk offered.
Cabot thought about this, glancing down at his hands and clothes, appearing to notice the dried filth for the first time.
Ugh,
he grunted. Then he turned back to the ladder.
You four, he ordered, pointing to the sailors nearest him. You're coming. Row the gig back here.
At once the sailors scrambled to obey, following Cabot down the ladder and out of sight. Oryk turned to Ambrose.
I don't want to know what rock you found him under, Ambrose, but I can't believe you're keeping him around. The man's utterly mad. He's as like to kill a man as ask him for directions, with no more thought to the matter than flipping a coin.
He doesn't have to be sane if he can track down Sicarius for me,
Ambrose growled, although he appeared somewhat relieved to have Cabot off the ship as well.
Peller says he killed at least two armor backs himself, one with his bare hands. I'm happy to keep him pointed at our enemies. Oh, that reminds me, he's still only one man. We'll need a few more for this. You've got a group of lads on call, don't you? Ones that don't mind getting their hands dirty?
Of course, Oryk replied.
Good. Get horses for them, too. If Sicarius is heading for the Abbey, we'll be able to catch him up before he arrives.
We?
Ambrose gave Oryk a mocking grin.
You're trying to get rid of me, cousin? Oh no, this is a family matter. You're with me to the end.
How delightful. I think we will start on my cabin today, Captain Dutrom said to Lieutenant Bristow as they stood on the dock, looking up at the cutlass. Get that damnable knot sawed out and replaced.
Very good, sir,
Bristow replied, making notes on a clipboard.
The Hotel Montrose recommended is comfortable enough, Dutrom said, but I do not like feeling so idle while the mission is ongoing. Clemence et Triade, and the expense.
Indeed, sir, it will be good to have you back aboard once more.
Dat be most true, sir, Giacomo said as he stepped up next to them.
Ah, Giacomo, Dutrom said, turning toward him. Excellent.
We'll be raising the new mainmast today as well, and we'll need you to climb.
His face paling, Dutrom stared up at Giacomo in disbelief as Bristow's clipboard fell to the dock with a clatter. The big man's grin spread wide as he brought himself to attention and saluted.
Giacomo be reporting for duty.
He laughed as Dutrom grasped his arm with a trembling hand.
Sorry to be scaring you like that, Captain, but most like Giacomo never be getting a better chance, nah?
It really is you, Dutrom gasped, his face breaking into a stunned smile. Le mot de fil, but it is,
he laughed, suddenly embracing Giacomo and kissing both of his cheeks. He stepped back, still smiling as Bristow recovered his own wits enough to enthusiastically pump Giacomo's hand. Then he paused, the wonder on his face returning to his familiar taciturn expression.
And Le Man Gauche, he is here as well?
He be alive too, Giacomo assured him, turning serious, but he be hurt badly.
He pointed toward the bay and lowered his voice.
We be rescued by the Osprey. Den last night, we be escaping from her.
Dutrom nodded. I knew there would be trouble from the moment she entered the bay, but I thought it was a spot of good fortune to see her attacked by armorbacks. A diversion so we be escaping, Giacomo explained. That be when the left hand be hurt. We be getting to shore, a mile or so west of the city, and he be sending Giacomo to you. Kayala needs be warned. The fiends be going to the abbey. They be chasing her.
Dutrom didn't waste time asking more questions.
So much for feeling idle, he said with grim satisfaction. Giacomo, you and I will call upon Master Montrose, his grace's commissioner here in my paw. He'll know the best way to get a fast message up to the abbey. In the meantime, Lieutenant, gather some men and our surgeon. Go to where Giacomo left Master Sicarius and bring him back to the ship.
At once, sir, Bristow said, snapping off a salute.
But as he turned to go, Giacomo put a hand on his arm.
Too late, he said, a far-off look in his eyes.
What do you mean? Dutrom asked. You said he was alive.
He be alive, Giacomo said. He be dying, but not yet dead.
He raised his head and looked west.
But he be moving.
I do not understand, the captain replied.
Giacomo no be understanding either, captain,
the islander replied. But he be certain. The left hand no longer be where Giacomo last be seeing him. He be moving, northwest.
Giacomo, I have learned not to doubt your insights, Dutrom said, seeing a strange look on his spotter's face, but this seems different than the predictions of an approaching storm. Are you telling me that you know where the left hand is?
Giacomo's brow furrowed. Be more like a compass, captain, and the needle be pointing at him.
How is that possible?
Giacomo no be knowing, the islander said, shrugging and throwing up his hands. He only be learning this since he be leaving the left-hand side this morning. But he be knowing for certain two things. The left hand be dying, and he be moving northwest.
I see, Dutrom replied. That sounds to me as if he is headed for the abbey himself. Very well, you and I will visit Master Montrose at least. Lieutenant, the ship is yours until my return.
Very good, sir.
In the home of Brendan Montrose, there came a particular knock at the door. Two knocks, followed by a single knock, then two more, and two more again. Roger, Montrose's secretary, raised his head and set his pen down. He recognized the knock at once. One of the guards was letting the house know that a visitor was arriving who might require more attention than the guards outside could provide. Roger left his desk and came to the door. Upon opening it, he peered curiously at the two men who had disembarked from the carriage. One had to be Captain Dutrom. Roger had worked for Montrose long enough to recognize the Kohaian uniform and insignia. The second man was a bizarre contrast to the first, a tall islander with a thick mass of dreadlocks and long, muscular arms. The islander had just helped the captain down from the carriage and was handing him a cane, which the captain accepted with a nod. Roger snapped his fingers, bringing a page up to him at a run.
"Inform Signor Montrose that Captain Dutrom has arrived unexpectedly."
Then, putting a polite smile on his face, he stepped outside to meet the pair.
"Captain Dutrom, is Signor Montrose expecting you?"
"He is not," said the older man, "but I must speak with him at once, on a matter of the utmost urgency."
"Very good, sir," Roger replied. "And this is?"
He glanced at the islander.
"Giacomo is one of my crew. It is he who has brought me the news that I must share."
"I see. Please come in out of the sun. I will arrange for some refreshment."
"Giacomo no be refusing any food, if truth be told," the dark man said.
"Indeed," Roger replied, glancing down at Giacomo's bare feet. "I will see what can be arranged."
The men from the Cutlass spent a few minutes cooling their heels in the foyer, the captain drumming his cane against the tiles, before Montrose came down a hallway.
"Sorry for the delay, Henri," he apologized, shaking Dutrom's hand.
He looked at Giacomo.
"And who is this fellow? A member of your crew?"
"Dis fellow be Giacomo," said the islander, cheerfully taking Montrose's hand. "He be rejoining de crew."
"Giacomo," Brendan said, looking puzzled at Dutrom. "Wasn't that the name of one of the fellows you said was lost
in the storm?" Dutrom finished. "Oui. There is much to tell, Brendan, and time is short. Where may we speak?"
"Come to my office," Brendan said at once, a calm, businesslike demeanor settling over him.
He led them down a hall and into a large, well-furnished chamber.
"Please sit."
There was a knock on the door, and the maid entered, carrying a loaded tea tray.
"Help yourselves, gentlemen."
"Maybe some food," Giacomo said. "Most time Giacomo no be so rude, Master Montrose, but he not be eaten much for several days."
"Of course," said Montrose. "Sonia, a platter of food for my guests, quick as you can."
The girl bobbed in acknowledgement and left.
"Now, Henri, why don't you start at the beginning?"
Dutrom explained the situation to Montrose, interrupted only by the maid returning with an array of sliced meat and bread. Giacomo silently assembled and ate several sandwiches in rapid succession, washing them down with cups of tea, only speaking to clarify one or two of Dutrom's points.
"Extraordinary," Montrose breathed.
His own cup of tea sat on the desk near him, untouched.
"I'm having trouble believing it all."
"Mon ami, I would not have believed it myself had I not suddenly found Giacomo standing before me only an hour ago. But now that we all know the story, we must act."
"Indeed," said Montrose.
He looked away for a moment, thinking.
"All right, I'll have to send out some runners, get some irons in the fire. It's going to be busy around here for a little while." "It's an imposition on your leg, Henri, I know, but perhaps you and Giacomo would like to wait on my roof terrace. It's very comfortable, and I'll have more food and drink sent up there."
Dutrom nodded reluctantly as he got to his feet.
"I understand. We'd be in the way down here."
"Exactly. I'll get things moving immediately. Do you want Giacomo to be the one delivering the message, or shall I dispatch a rider?"
"Giacomo never be riding a horse before," the islander commented.
"A rider, then."
Montrose pulled a cord hanging from the wall, and the sound of a bell could be heard elsewhere in the manor. He pulled it again, three times in quick succession. A moment later, the maid Sonia entered.
"Sonia, show these two gentlemen to the roof terrace and bring them anything they might require."
An instant later, Roger appeared in the doorway, looking as if he had run through the manor to get there.
"You rang, sir?"
"Yes, come in. We have some urgent work ahead of us."
Dutrom and Giacomo passed Roger and left the room, Sonia leading them.
"I'll be up as soon as I have any news, Henri," Montrose called after him.
Giacomo helped his captain up the stairs.
"Giacomo be thinking the rooftop best be the nicest one in the whole city if he be sending us up there," he grumbled.
Dutrom laughed.
"I have been up there before, when I was a guest of Brendan's father. The view is quite beautiful. I dare say we will be able to see the Cutlass from there."
When they stepped out onto the roof, Giacomo beamed.
Oh, yes, dove you be most beautiful, Captain.
He turned around in a circle, smiling.
Still, Giacomo be hoping we no be sitting up here long.
As Dutram nodded, the maid stepped forward.
Is there anything you require, sir?
Perhaps some fruit, mademoiselle? Dutram asked, a refreshing change to the palate.
Sonia curtsied and left the terrace. Dutram limped to the patio at the front of the house, Giacomo following behind.
Giacomo be seeing to cut this from here, just as you be saying.
Dutram chuckled and took out his spyglass.
I fear I must need this to do the same.
He knew where he needed to look to find his ship, and in a moment he was gazing upon her, noting the scurrying activity of the work crews.
Blisto has them hot at it, he said with a smile.
The smile faded as he surveyed the damage still to be repaired.
We sailed in not long after dawn, with the sun behind us. The city was glittering with the reflections of spyglasses turned in our direction.
He lowered his own glass, looking grim.
Now I see why. How would she have looked to the citizens of Maipo, a twisted shadow limping into port? More frightening than I would have imagined.
What be happening on the Cutlass, no man be imagining, Giacomo said. So no one here be expecting it either. Giacomo be telling you, sir, he be feeling scared when he first be seeing her in the harbor this morning. He no be understanding how much the ship be changed until he be seeing her from afar.
Dutram nodded.
I have had to hire laborers to assist in the repairs. That same fear is in the eyes of many of them. That may go somewhere toward explaining the speed at which they are working. They want the job to be over with.
He sighed.
I believe we have underestimated the effect we are having on this city. Everyone is watching the Cutlass and coming to the father knows what sort of conclusions. That, as much as anything, cannot have escaped Count Valion's attention.
What sort of man be this, Count?
The latest in a long line of clever men. The Traderi are said to be the best chess players in the Frieze, and from what I have heard, Valion lives up to that reputation. He's old and cautious now, maintaining the realm for his son's inheritance. I have heard it said that he tries to bore his enemies into making a mistake.
Then, hearing a noise behind him, Dutram turned, raising a hand to wave at the maid who had just come out with a tray of assorted fruits.
Just set it on the table by the back patio, mademoiselle, and thank you.
He turned back to Giacomo.
Are you still hungry? Not at present, Captain, but most like Giacomo be getting hungry again soon enough.
As Dutram settled himself into a nearby chair, impatiently drumming his cane on the wooden planks, Giacomo strolled around the front patio, looking out at the city below him with idle curiosity. Some minutes later, he looked down at the harbor again, and he froze in surprise.
Captain, there be soldiers down by the Cutlass.
Dutram struggled up from his seat, rejoining his sailor at the rail and bringing the spyglass back to his eye.
Troops assigned to the harbor authority, he confirmed. We have found ourselves on Valion's chessboard, it seems.
He studied the activity below in grim silence.
At least Valion has not removed his velvet glove. The seizure appears to be a peaceful one. But Lieutenant Bristow knows how to pick his battles. Resistance would be useless at this point. Valion could have taken the ship by force, but he has not. This is an opening move, not an end game.
He glanced down at the building beneath their feet.
What concerns me now is what, or who, might have prompted him to make this move.
The tall islander's eyes widened.
Montrose!
There was something in young Brendan's behavior that put me on my guard, Dutram admitted. We passed one perfectly good parlor on the ground floor while going to his office. But instead of having us wait there, he sends us all the way up here, out of the way.
Giacomo groaned.
Meantime he be sending word to the Count? But why? He be the Duke's man in Maipo.
The Duke's man, but in the Count's city. I look forward to finding out what Brendan's motives are in this matter, the Malakan said with an angry smile.
He turned away and began to quickly limp toward the rear of the terrace, Giacomo following behind, confused. Dutram reached the edge and looked down into the lush, carefully tended foliage in the backyard of the manor. He leaned over the rail, examining the wall beneath them.
Giacomo, he asked, could you climb down from here?
The islander looked over the wall and chuckled.
Many places on Bakaruto be harder to climb than this, and Giacomo once be climbing doors every day.
He looked at Utram.
Giacomo be taking de warning to Kerla himself, na?
Oui. Valion is closing his fist around us, but his grip is not yet firm, and our duty is clear. His Grace's agents must be warned of what has transpired.
Giacomo turned back to the table and filled his pockets with as much fruit as he could carry. Dutram took his purse off his belt and handed that to him as well.
The money may be of use to you, though I would not linger in the city itself to spend it.
Giacomo be understanding, the islander replied, accepting the purse, then snapped off a jaunty salute. Winds be keeping you safe, Captain.
Dutram returned the gesture. Bonne chance. He leaned over the railing, watching as Giacomo began his descent. The islander gripped small crevices in the brickwork with his fingers and toes as if they were rungs on a ladder, and with surprising speed he reached the roof of the floor below them. Moving quickly and silently, he ran to the edge of that roof and began his next descent, disappearing from Dutram's sight. Perhaps a minute later, Dutram glimpsed a dark shape moving through the thick foliage of Montrose's estate, quickly climbing over the rear wall and slipping into the city. With a sigh, the captain walked back to the table and settled himself into a chair. He peeled the last orange on the tray and began to eat the sections one by one, waiting. It was only another 5 minutes before he heard several sets of feet making their way up through the building, and in short order, the door to the terrace opened. The first man to step out was armed and wearing the uniform of one of the Count's guards, though Dutram was pleased to see that his sword was not drawn. He quickly scanned the terrace, locating Dutram at once, then held the door open. The man that followed was older, his thick mustache an equal mix of gray and black hair, and had far more decoration and insignia upon his jacket than the guard. Dutram pushed himself to his feet and stood waiting. A second guard came out after the officer, followed last by Brendan Montrose, who also looked around the terrace, quickly turning confused. Dutram hid his smile as the officer approached him.
Captain Dutram, said the man, giving him a formal salute. Major Torrio at your service.
And I at yours, Major, Dutram replied, returning the salute.
I cannot imagine that you are here to join me for a meal.
Torrio gave him a reluctant smile.
I am afraid not, but let me first express my admiration to the man who slew the notorious pirate, Sidois.
Dutram smiled, thanking whatever instinct had warned him to leave the pirate's survival out of his account to Montrose.
The Le Rouge attacked us, but sank in the storm that came upon us as we fought. The Triad must receive more credit than I for the victory.
As you say, sir. My master, Count Valion, is eager to hear a full account of the battle, and he has invited you to dine with him tonight.
Dutram did not bother glancing at the guards flanking Torrio as the two officers shared a smile, one professional to another.
How could I refuse? Dutram said.
Wait, said Montrose. There were two of them up here, Dutram and some islander. I had a man watching the stairs. No one came down. Where is he? He demanded.
I suppose that is another question for his lordship to ask me over dinner,
Dutram replied, keeping his focus on Torrio.
I would not want our conversation to run out before the second course.
The Myporian officer looked amused at Montrose's sputtering reaction, giving Dutram a nod.
Your reputation for cleverness precedes you, sir, the officer replied. I believe his lordship will not be disappointed with this invitation. Shall we? Lead on, Major.
This work is copywritten 2013 and has been written and recorded by John Maher. If you'd like to learn more about the Freeze, get yourself a bit of swag, or comment on this episode, please visit talesoftheleftand.com, where you can also find a link to our official Facebook page, and if you'd like, make a donation to help keep this series going. Thanks for listening.